Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The iconic red and white Coca-Cola logo is recognized instantly around the world. 1.7 billion servings of Coke products are consumed every day. Coca-Cola was invented in May of 1886 by John Pemberton. Today, you can buy a Coke in the most remote parts of the world. It's sold in every country except Cuba and North Korea. The company plans to spend $200 million over the next 5 years to open a beverage plant in Myanmar. Around the world, the average person drinks a Coke product every 4 days, and Americans who regularly drink Coke ingest about 10 pounds of sugar a year. Through mass marketing, advertising, and political influence, Coca-Cola has helped to alter not only consumption patterns, but also attitudes toward leisure, work, advertising, sex, family life, and patriotism. Coca-Cola spends almost $3 billion a year on advertising, more than Microsoft and Apple combined. And it recently posted revenues of almost $13 billion for the last quarter alone. So how did a drink, which is 99% sugar water, gain so much power in the world? In his latest book, For God, Country and Coca-Cola, The Definitive History of the Great American Soft Drink and the Company That Makes It, today's guest, Mark Pendergrast, gives us a comprehensive history of Coca-Cola, from its invention as a cocaine-laced medicine in the Gilded Age to a symbol of global consumer capitalism. Mark is the author of several books. For God, Country and Coca-Cola is in its third edition, and it contains the original secret formula. And Mark joins us from Vermont. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So your book is almost 500 pages, really interesting information. And you actually have a personal connection to Coca-Cola. Your grandfather, J.B. Pendergrast, owned a drugstore at Little Five Points in Atlanta, where he served Coca-Cola to Asa Candler, the first Coca-Cola tycoon. Is that when your interest in Coca-Cola first began, when you learned about this history?
No, you know, I mean, I grew up sort of in the shade of a giant Coca-Cola bottle, as everybody does in Atlanta, and almost every native has some kind of connection to the company, but it didn't really register on me. It's just the kind of thing that you assume, you know, it's part of the air that you breathe, almost. But it wasn't until a friend of mine was working for the company, and he sent me their magazine, and I saw, you know, number one, it was sort of monomaniacal. It was showing all these people all over the world delivering Coca-Cola. Seem to have something,
Mark,
some trouble with the line here.
Do you have a cell phone on?
Yeah.
That might be your cell phone.
It's not a cell phone. Anyway. I just couldn't believe that it occurred to me for the first time that this was the world's most widely distributed product that I had just taken for granted. And I began to be curious about it. So I did not write the book because I grew up in Atlanta exactly, but because I am curious. And I thought, how did this come to be? The question that you just asked, how in the world did this product that was invented in 1886 in my home city of Atlanta, how did it become so widespread and come to mean so much to people? You know, I remembered that in 1985, when they changed the flavor of Coke to New Coke, how everyone had a complete meltdown over it and how weird I thought that was. So there were a variety of reasons, and I didn't actually know that my grandfather was involved with an early court case until I started doing the research, and lo and behold, there he was testifying in 1914.
And if your grandfather had kept his stock, you probably would have been a wealthy guy by now, but he sold it to build a house.
That's true. Or on the other side of my family, my mother's mother nearly married Robert Woodruff, who is the second big tycoon for Coca-Cola, who's known as the boss, who took over the company for many, many years.
Well, so you brought up what happened in 1985 when Coke decided to change the formula. And I understand that the company gave you a file with letters from people who wrote to them. And I think this just really shows us how how important Coke is to people. I mean, I was laughing when I read or I heard this, but, you know, some people said, you know, I don't drink coffee, I don't drink tea or water, I just drink Coke all day long. Quote, changing Coke is like breaking the American dream. Another person said, until you bring the old Coke back, I'm going to drink RC because the old Coke is in my blood. What did this really reveal to you when you read these letters?
Well, they acted like someone had killed God. It made it clear that, you know, the title of my book is somewhat ironic, For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, but in many ways it's absolutely true. People really took this drink so seriously. And, you know, they're also, you must have seen the letters that people wrote when 3 months later they brought back Coca-Cola Classic. You know, they wrote things like, thank God for Coca-Cola, we do have it great in America, or God does work in mysterious ways, and I thank him for answering my prayers to bring back the real Coke, or my favorite, the old Coke recipe reflects the love of every good American today. There's only one Holy Bible, one Elvis Presley. Others have tried to copy them, but never quite make it. They're just really amazing.
And so so today, Coke is in almost every country around the world except Cuba and North Korea?
Well, it's actually in every country in the world. You can buy it in Cuba and North Korea. It's just not it's not bottled there, and it's on the black market in Cuba and North Korea.
So how did this happen? I mean, you go back to when it was invented in 1886 by John Pemberton, and initially he tried to find out how he could modify this French wine, coca, which was wildly successful. Talk a little bit about that and what exactly that contained and why people loved it so much.
Well, he was imitating a drink called Vin Mariani. And he created something that he called French wine coca, which was clearly a Vin Mariani ripoff. And at that time, Vin Mariani was about as famous as Coca-Cola is now. It was a Bordeaux wine with an infusion of coca leaf, so it had both alcohol and cocaine. And Mariani was a genius at getting celebrity endorsements. So he had endorsements from Queen Victoria, love the stuff, so did Thomas Edison, so did Emile Zola, and so did Pope Leo XIII. So everybody drank this stuff, which had a substantial kick of cocaine in it. Pemberton himself, it turns out, was a morphine addict, and he thought that cocaine was harmless, as did most people in the 1880s, and that it was a way to get himself weaned from morphine. So he gave these interviews that were just full of praise of the coca leaf and its constituent, which was cocaine. And he was doing very well with French wine coca, but then Atlanta voted to go dry. There were a lot of saloons, a lot of alcoholism in 1885, and it was supposed to take effect July the 1st of 1886. So Pemberton thought that French wine coca might be banned because of this. You'd think it would have been. So he modified it, and that's what Coca-Cola is. It turns out they never did ban French wine coca. He could call it a medicine and still sell it, but he didn't know that.
And so this was really based on, initially, medicine, right?
Primarily. Soda fountains were also very, very popular. They were big, ornate marble affairs, sometimes 100 feet long. And there was a huge competition, not just among patent medicines, but among soda fountain drinks. And Pemberton's drink was supposed to be both. So from the very beginning, it was supposed to be a delicious, refreshing soda fountain drink. But it was also a patent medicine that was supposed to cure hangovers, headaches, something called neurasthenia, which was a mythical disease. The idea was that you had depleted your store of nervous energy and needed a drug to replenish it. And it was supposed to be an aphrodisiac as well and cure impotency. It cured what ailed you.
So the original drink was named after its two primary drug constituents, cocaine from fluid extract of coca leaves, which was the wonder drug in the 1880s, and then caffeine from cola nuts. And in 1903, this is a fascinating story, they took out the cocaine. Can you talk about why they decided to do that?
Yeah, first, let me just have a small correction here. They never named Coca-Cola after cocaine. They named it after coca leaf, which is what cocaine naturally is part of. The company will tell you with a straight face that original Coca-Cola never had cocaine added to it. And they're right if you look at it in a very narrow sense. No one ever put white powder into the drink, at least not the makers of it. What they did do was to make fluid extract of coca leaf, and of course that contained a small amount of cocaine. That's where cocaine comes from. And by the turn of the century, it had become clear that cocaine was an addictive drug that had a bad effect on many people. But the real reason that it was taken out in 1903 in the Deep South was that there was a great deal of racism. This was the Jim Crow era. And there were rumors that people were, that black men were drinking Coca-Cola and getting high and raping white women and killing their bosses, et cetera. So there was a lot of pressure on Coca-Cola to remove the drug. They did remove it. Although they continued to use coca leaf in their formula, but they decocainized it first, and they continue to do that to this day.
Where did those rumors originate?
Rumors of what?
Of the black about the black men.
Oh, well, they were in newspapers. A lot of politicians were bruiting them about. There was a guy named Thomas Watson who was a demagogue in Georgia who was saying things like this. There was an article in the New York Times talking about it around that time. So it was widespread.
And so did that get much publicity at that time, that they decided to take it out? And how did people respond?
Well, they were kind of in a tight spot. They couldn't really advertise that it ever did have cocaine in it. So they didn't announce that they'd taken it out. They just quietly did it. And it took quite a bit of digging and looking in old court cases and letters for me to find documentation of it. But that is clearly what they did. It's ironic that a few years later, the United States government sued Coca-Cola after they had taken the cocaine out. And one of the things that they sued them for was that it was misbranded, that it shouldn't be called Coca-Cola because that implied that it had a whole coca leaf in it, and it no longer had whole coca leaf in it. Of course, they could have sued them earlier because it had cocaine in it. But the real reason they sued was because of the caffeine content. A guy named Harvey Wiley, who was also, he was sort of the Ralph Nader of his time. He was very popular crusader who managed to get the Pure Food and Drug Act passed in 1906 and who was the first head of what is now the FDA. He hated Coca-Cola, and he got the government to sue them primarily because he regarded it as a drug drink with caffeine in it that was being given to children. And the company nearly was put out of business, barely survived this lawsuit, and as a result, they never showed children under the age of 12 drinking Coke in any ads ever again.
And how much was a Coke in the early 1900s?
It was a nickel. It remained a nickel from 1886 until 1955,
wow.
Approximately.
That's a long time.
And the reason that they were able to do that was because it was so cheap to produce it. There was a massive profit margin, still is a massive profit margin, but it was big enough that it could stay a nickel for a very long time. It was only with the inflation in the post-war period that they were forced to raise the price. And at around that same time, they were also forced to come out with king-size Coke. They had been having a 6.5-ounce bottle ever since they started bottling it in 1899. Pepsi came along during the Depression and started bottling it in 12-ounce beer bottles, recycled beer bottles, and charging a nickel for that. So you could get twice as much for a nickel, too, as the Pepsi jingle very proudly stated. It gave Pepsi a negative, low-class image. You really were poor and cheap if you drank a Pepsi. But it also boosted Pepsi sales very quickly during the Depression.
So 5 cents until 1955. How much is a bottle of Coke
today?
Well,
you know, the price changed in the early 50s. But by 1955, the nickel price was pretty much dead. I'm sorry, what were you asking?
How much is it today?
Oh, gosh. How much is a 12-ounce bottle of Coke cost
do you
today?
Drink, I, do you drink Coke?
Hmm? You know, I do drink it sometimes. I bought for like $2.50 a bottle of sugar sweetened Coke that was imported from Mexico the other day because I prefer that. But I don't drink much of it.
How much does sugar
drink,
sweet?
I don't drink a whole lot of it. Also, I had one the other day that somebody gave me at one of my interviews. It was a little mini can. They're 8 ounces. It's funny, that's bigger than the old drinks, but I quite like the mini can because it holds the fizz better, so I like it.
Does sugar-sweetened Coke have even more sugar than the original Coke?
No, it has about the same amount of sugar. It's a lot of sugar.
Yeah, it's a lot of sugar.
It's like, I think, 9 teaspoons or something of the equivalent. In a 12-ounce Coke.
Wow.
It's a lot of sugar if you get sugar sweetened.
We're talking with Mark Pendergrast about his book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola sells more than 3,500 beverages, and they have a lot of brands. 33 non-alcoholic brands generate over $1 billion in revenue. They own 15 of them, including Sprite, Dasani Bottled Water, Minute Maid, and Odwalla. And so we're talking today about how this corporation became so powerful. And how were they able to penetrate the country's psyche? If you have any questions about Coke and its history, we'll talk about how it affects the environment, our health, workers' rights. We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Coke is sold in every country, as we learned, even on the black market in Cuba. And they're planning to open a new beverage plant in Burma or Myanmar, spending $200 million over the next 5 years. So what is it about Coke? Why is it that you can go to some of the most remote parts of the world and still buy a Coke? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. So I want you to tell another really interesting story about history. During World War II, when Pearl Harbor happened, Robert Woodruff said that fighting men will always have access to Coca-Cola, no matter where they are in the world, for 5 cents. It was kind of a moral booster for soldiers. Can you talk about that? And how important was that moment?
Well, it was a pivotal moment for the company. Robert Woodruff had decided that he would try to promote Coca-Cola outside the United States in the late 1920s. And with limited success, he'd been able to do that, but it was only in a few countries that it was doing quite well by the time World War II broke out. Ironically, one of those was inside Nazi Germany. Coca-Cola was doing very well, and I have a whole chapter about the appearance of the swastika right next to the Coca-Cola logo at their meetings where they were leading chants of Sieg Heil to Hitler. So it's kind of ironic that at the same time that was happening, Woodruff was saying, we'll get Coca-Cola to our fighting men wherever they are. And the result of that was that Coca-Cola was deemed an essential morale booster for the troops. They put Coca-Cola men in army uniforms, called them technical observers, which was a designation for civilians who were essential to the war effort, sent them overseas where they started 64 bottling plants behind the lines during World War II to supply Coca-Cola to the troops. And I've always thought this would make an incredible movie. Mm. In fact, I wrote a letter to George Clooney's agent. I thought George Clooney would make a wonderful TO, a technical observer, because they were real swashbucklers. Some of them ended up, you know, trading Coke for sex, and it was an interesting period of time. But what that meant was that the soldiers, it really was a morale booster for them. I've got these, you talk about letters, I've got these letters from the GIs saying what it meant to them to get a Coca-Cola when they were in a trench somewhere in Italy. And they came back with a devotion to the product, and also in the rest of the world, they were set up for expansion after the war, and that's really when Coca-Cola became an international drink, was in the post-World War II era.
And Robert Woodruff was the president of the Coca-Cola Company from 1923 until 1954. What kind of relationship did he have with politicians?
Woodruff was very good friends with Dwight Eisenhower. He played golf with him, and he got Eisenhower to put money into a Coca-Cola bottling plant in South America. So he and his cronies decided that Eisenhower should run for president. And they were even going to the point of figuring out whether he should run as a Democrat or a Republican. I found a letter from Eisenhower to Woodruff in the archives down at Emory, where Woodruff had complained to Ike that he'd seen a picture of him sipping Coca-Cola out of a straw, through, you know, a bottle with a straw in it. And that's a sissy way to drink Coke. You should drink it, you know, straight from the bottle. And Eisenhower was defending himself in this letter by saying, well, this way I could sip it more slowly and have more photo opportunities. This is the president of the United States.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. But, you know, Coke also had a very close relationship later with Jimmy Carter. Pepsi had a very close relationship with Joe McCarthy and with Richard Nixon. So the colas have always been political.
And they had a lot of power, obviously, back then. And is it because politicians saw that they were about to really expand? Or, you know, why did he have access to Eisenhower?
Well, Coca-Cola was a very powerful corporation. They had a lot of money, and they could, you know, help and influence in a campaign. But Eisenhower also believed in big business, and it wasn't. And a lot of it was just personal relations. Woodruff had a big plantation down in South Georgia called Itchaway, where he would have people he liked come and go hunt quail, and it was a very gracious lifestyle. So it was, that's how the world worked.
Well, let's take a caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Craig in San Francisco. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. Hey, I had heard a rumor that folks that drink a lot of Coke, like myself, internally in Coca-Cola, are called heavy users. That seems ridiculous. I was wondering if it's true, and if so, how much do you have to drink to be one?
How much Coke do you drink, Craig?
I'd say 4 cans a day.
A day?
Wow. Yeah.
I'd say that's kind of a lot. Do you drink it because you have to, or, I mean, is it the caffeine that you're kind of, that you like?
I would say a love and an addiction.
Yeah.
Both. Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Craig. Mark?
So what's the question?
What's the question? He's concerned that people drink too much Coke.
No, can I repeat it again? Am I still on?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I had heard the rumor that internally at Coca-Cola, at the operation, people who drink a lot of Coke, they were referred to as heavy users.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, and you're objecting because that's the same kind of phrase that people use for drug addicts, right? Yeah, a heavy user just means somebody who drinks a lot of the stuff, such as you. Do you drink the sugar-sweetened regular variety? I mean, or I guess not sugar-sweetened, high-fructose corn syrup-sweetened variety?
You know, we're going to actually have to go to break, so hold that question. And actually, we got another question from a listener who wondered if they're still putting corn syrup in Coke. And you do have the original secret formula in your book, but we'll find out about corn syrup right after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco 91.7 FM. Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss coverage of Walmart protests happening today in 15 cities. It's expected to be the largest protest since the ones on Black Friday. And then we will also talk about how the media are covering the Obama administration's plans for striking Syria. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted to strike yesterday. The House is expected to vote today. Representative Alan Grayson says he expects there to be a massive no vote in the House. And so we'll get the latest on media coverage tomorrow. And then on Monday, we'll have a more in-depth conversation about why the administration wants to strike. Why are they so adamant on striking Syria? And so if you have questions about that, be sure to tune in on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Mark Pendergrast about his book, For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, The Definitive History of the Great American Soft Drink and the Company That Makes It. The iconic red and white logo is recognized by about 95% of the world's population. 1.7 billion servings of Coke products are consumed every single day. Coke also owns Dasani Water, Minute Maid, Odwalla, many other drinks. It posted revenues of about $13 billion for the last quarter alone. If you have any questions, we actually have full lines, but we'll have one open in a few minutes. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Craig, are you still with us?
I'm here, yeah.
Okay, so Mark wanted to know if you drink the sugar sweetened Coke. You drink four a day.
I do. In fact, right now, though, I am drinking a Mexican Coke without the high fructose corn syrup.
So are these Mexican?
So, Craig, how much? I want to know whether you're overweight.
I had a feeling you might ask me that. I am not overweight. I box three times a week. I'm pretty fit.
Yep.
And
do you do that? If you're drinking the four Cokes a day, you are getting a fair amount of calories from doing that. So either you're cutting down on other stuff or you just really must exercise a whole lot.
To be honest, before this year, I didn't need to exercise much to stay fit. And then I got older and kept drinking Coke, and now I box.
Yep. Okay. Just curious. The company is being blamed a lot for the obesity epidemic right now, and they've reacted to that by coming out with ads explaining what they think they're doing right to try to help prevent obesity, and that's something we might want to talk about later in the show, Rose.
Yes, definitely. Well, thank you so much, Craig. Mark, how hard is it to break a Coke habit? I don't drink Coke, so I don't know, but how hard is it?
Well, it's mostly the caffeine, which is an addictive drug, and I've written about caffeine in another book also. I wrote a history of coffee called Uncommon Grounds. So I know a fair amount about caffeine, and it's hard to break the addiction, but it's not impossible, and the withdrawal symptoms, although they can be pretty severe, don't last very long, less than a week in general. So it's more of a psychological addiction than so much physical. And the good news about caffeine is that a lot of epidemiological studies are showing that it's not only not bad for you, but can be good for you, at least in moderate amounts. People who drink caffeine tend to commit suicide less often. They tend to have less liver cancer. So it's surprising after being told that it stunts your growth all this time.
And is there still high fructose corn syrup in Coke?
Absolutely. In the United States, Coca-Cola is sweetened with high fructose corn syrup because we have a protective tariff on imported sugar. So it makes the corn syrup cheaper. I don't approve of it. I don't like it very much, but that's what it is.
Well, we've got a related email from Linda who says, I drink Coke because it helps with my acid reflux condition. I don't like that it helps, but it does like nothing else, and it's the only reason I drink it. I don't like that they're such a huge corporation since I try not to support them. I don't like the ingredients. I hate that there's so much sugar in it. Most days, one Coke a day works, but on some days, I have to drink more. I appreciate that it works. I just wish this huge corporation would be open to supporting more jobs in the U.S. and being more socially and environmentally environmentally responsible. Thank you, Linda, and we'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. But first, let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Oh, hi there. I was wondering if the Mark could comment on, I don't know if this was a part of marketing, that I'm finding that carbonated drinks, I don't like Coke because I don't like the taste of it and I don't like the sugar, but some of their basically affiliates or whatever they brought out, like Sprite and other things which I like better, or Diet Sprite, I find it quenches thirst way more than just straight water, and I'm wondering if that's part of the formula. Did they do anything to make it so thirst-quenching?
Well, I like Sprite, too, actually. But I don't think it actually does literally quench your thirst any better. It's just that people prefer to have a nice taste along with their liquid. Let me just respond to a few other things that people said. The former caller was talking about that Coke was this big evil corporation that does bad things for the environment or should do more. The fact is, it has a mixed record. But Coca-Cola has given millions of dollars to the World Wildlife Fund to try to help save major river basins, to try to help save the environment for polar bears. And I think this is all good. It's very hard to argue with that. They have also, they're aiming to have all of their vending machines, of which there are large, large numbers, not produce greenhouse gases anymore. So, and they're using a lot of vehicles that are electric powered or in other ways not using fossil fuel. So they are quite conscious of a lot of these things. And you can argue that they're doing it only to look good, but the fact that they're doing it, I think, is a good thing. Now, they've been criticized in many ways for their what they've done to the environment in terms of, for one thing, simply, you know, shipping a non-essential product all over the place, but also for their use of water in India particularly. They were criticized for depleting the water table in areas that were drought-stricken. And there's some truth to that, although a lot of what they've done, a lot of the water problems in India have nothing to do with Coca-Cola. They have to do with very bad agricultural practices. So I really did look at all of these issues very carefully in the book, but I think that it's not a black and white issue of, oh, this is the evil monster corporation of the Western world, but they certainly do need watchdogging.
That is Mark Pendergrast, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. And speaking of corporate responsibility, I'd like to welcome our next guest, Michael Blandine, to the show. Michael is author of The Coke Machine, The Dirty Truth Behind the World's Favorite Soft Drink. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show. Hello, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you for joining us. So why did you decide to write a book about Coke, focusing on just what we were discussing, on corporate responsibility?
Well, I first heard about some of the issues involving Coke in 2004 when I attended a presentation at the Democratic National Convention here in Boston. And it was put on by a number of activists, some from India talking about the water issues that Mark just mentioned, but also some union members from Colombia who were talking about the Coca-Cola company being complicit in violence against union members there at the bottling plant, including allegations of their complicity in murder of several union members. And it just struck me so dramatically that here is this company that we associate with the highest values of, you know, peace, love, and world harmony, and all of the other really positive associations that Coca-Cola has sold to us and its advertising, being accused of these kind of heinous acts. And it just, you know, as somebody who has looked into corporate accountability in a number of ways as a reporter, it just struck me as such rich territory to explore, and I found that a lot of compelling evidence to back up some of the allegations against the company.
And if you wouldn't mind, Michael, if you can speak up a little bit, we're having a few issues with your line.
Sure.
That's better. So what, in your research, what really struck you about Coke's practices that are not widely known?
I think you know, some of the water issues that Mark has mentioned were cases where some of the business practices of the company have been most carefully documented. And while it's true that in places like India, they're dealing with drought issues from other sources, the presence of Coca-Cola bottling plants in areas that are particularly stricken by drought has really exacerbated the problems, and not only in water depletion, but also pollution. I visited some villages where I would literally tasted water from wells that had, you know, a really sickly chemical taste, you know, that was located right next to a Coca-Cola bottling plant. And there's a lot of evidence that there are heavy metals from the plant that got into the water supply and the groundwater. And, you know, Coca-Cola actually put forth its own study looking at some of these plants, and its own study recommended that some of these bottling plants be closed in these drought-stricken areas, and yet they, at the end of the day, they backed off of that and said, well, you know, we think it's better to be in these areas and to stay engaged and be part of the conversation, and sort of all of these wishy-washy kind of words that they used in order to maintain their presence there. And, you know, it really kind of drives home the fact that a company like Coca-Cola, while I don't think they're this huge evil corporation, or they're, you know, certainly even the worst corporation in the world in terms of its environmental practices, but I think that they really want to have it both ways. They want to sell their product based on this image that they've created of teaching the world to sing and world harmony. And at the same time, they're not walking the walk on the ground in the communities where they're located. And I found, you know, time and time again, five examples of that.
Mark, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I also wrote about, Michael, I read your book, and it was very helpful when I was doing the third edition. I'm glad to be on the same show with you. Hello.
Hi. Well, I used your book quite a bit in my chapters about background as well, so it's nice to get a chance to talk to you.
Okay. Let's talk about Colombia for a second, Michael. You can chime in on this, too. There were a number of union leaders who were not only intimidated but murdered, one of them inside a Coca-Cola bottling plant in Colombia during the 1990s. And they tried to sue over this. The lawsuit was eventually thrown out because it's very difficult to sue for something that happened in a foreign country. But this was not a new issue. There was a Coca-Cola bottler in Guatemala in the late 1970s, mm-hmm. Where he didn't like communists and he didn't like Pepsi and he didn't like union leaders. And there was a good deal of evidence that he was in collusion with death squads to murder his union employees. The question was there proof that the Coke bottlers were complicit with the paramilitaries in Colombia? Was there proof in Guatemala? And that's difficult to get. It would appear, I think there was pretty good evidence that they were involved in it. And the Coca-Cola company in Atlanta, there's very little evidence. In fact, there's no evidence that they knew about this or were involved in it. On the other hand, what the big company likes to do is to say, well, you know, that's our bottler and they're independent and we don't have anything to do with them. And the fact is that the bottler wouldn't exist except for Big Coke. Coca-Cola right. must sell them their syrup. So they are responsible around the world for whatever anyone does that has the name Coca-Cola on it. So I didn't really buy that argument. Michael, why don't you comment on that?
Right. No, I agree with everything that you just said. I mean, there was certainly no smoking gun evidence that tied executives in Atlanta to the murders that happened at that particular camp or several plants in Colombia. But there was a lot of circumstantial evidence that the local plant managers knew about the violence, even condoned the violence. The violence happened, you know, in particular at times when union members were negotiating their contracts with the company and were clearly used as a means of intimidation. But I think that for me, the most damning evidence against the company in Atlanta, the way that I do believe that they're complicit in this, is their real lack of a follow through in investigating the crimes that took place there. There was a series of, there's a series of protests on campuses in the 2000s that really drew attention to this issue and the lawsuit that, that Mark mentioned. And several campuses across the country, including several really big universities like University of Michigan and New York University, banned Coca-Cola products because of this incident in Colombia, and it really caused the company to take note of that and to try to address it. But the investigations they did were just a series of past measures where they would just investigate, you know, conditions at the bottling plants and whether, you know, people were paid what they were supposed to be paid, whether there were fire extinguishers available on the plant floor. And they never really went back and interviewed the people who were there at the time of the violence and really tried to get to the bottom of what actually happened and how they might change their practices to create more more accountability from these individual companies that operate in other countries, which, as you say, bear the Coke name and, you know, the workers all wear the Coke uniforms and, you know, they really can't have it both ways and say that on the one hand, well, that's an independent company, that's nothing to do with us, and on the other hand, say that, you know, they just wash their hands of it. So I think that's the most damning evidence against the company is just looking at how they really manipulated these activists who are really trying to get to the bottom of the truth of the issue and with these series of investigations that were real whitewashed is.
And that is Michael Blandin. He's a journalist and author of The Coke Machine, The Dirty Truth Behind the World's Favorite Soft Drink. We're also joined by Mark Pendergrast. He is the author of several books, including the third edition of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, The Definitive History of the Great American Soft Drink and the Company That Makes It. And we've got about 10 minutes left, and we have full lines and a ton of emails about this. So let's try to go through a few calls, and we'll get responses from Mark and Michael. Let's go to Jane in Corte Madera. Hi, Jane.
Good morning. Thank you. This is a marvelous show. Are you going to do you rerun it anytime today?
It'll be on KALW tonight at 11 p.m.
11 p.m.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a fabulous show. I heard on NPR just yesterday that China has the highest diabetes rate of any country in the world, and I suspect they use a lot of Coke, drink a lot of Coca-Cola, because I'm sure Coca-Cola saw a great market. And could you comment
well,
on that, please?
I can address that, if you don't mind.
Mark.
This is Mark.
Sure.
The fact is, China has a very low per capita consumption of Coca-Cola compared to the United States or Mexico, which has the highest rate. Mexico, by the way, also has the highest rate of obesity in the world. Surprise. The fact that diabetes is so bad in China cannot be attributed, certainly in large measure, to Coke. But the fact is, their per capita is growing very quickly. In the 2008 Olympics, which I wrote about in Beijing, Coca-Cola went all out to sponsor it and to promote it, despite the horrible things that China was doing in Tibet at the time. And they have formed a joint partnership with the Chinese government for many of their Coca-Cola plants there. So they're growing very, very quickly in China. I show a slideshow, a PowerPoint thing, when I give speeches about Coca-Cola, and the very last slide shows Chinese children drinking Coca-Cola with a big thing under it saying "the future?" question mark. So Coca-Cola sees China as eventually being its largest market in the world. It seems inevitable that that will be true. And so I think it is a concern as to what sugar drinks they're drinking. The company, by the way, points out that about a quarter of all their drinks now are low-calorie or no-calorie, and they're very much aware that that's the way the world is shifting. So they are trying to address that issue. You know, for $4.1 billion, they bought Vitamin Water, or the Glasso, the company that makes Vitamin Water, a few years ago. So they're frantically trying to diversify.
And according to the Xinhua News Service, Ahmet Bozer, the president of Coca-Cola, says they plan to invest $4 billion just in China alone next year. And as you said, this is interesting data, Mark, that the Chinese drink an average of 39 bottles of Coke per year, and in the U.S., 400 a year? That's average?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
That's more than one a day.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for calling. And also, the Chinese diabetes rate, 12% of Chinese adults have diabetes, 113 million people, and 3 out of 4 don't even know they have it, according to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Those are massive numbers. So thank you so much for calling in, Jane. Let's go next to Richard in Berkeley. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I have a question about the issue of aspartame being consumed by people who drink the diet beverages, and especially in the teen years, the aspartic acid and phenylalanine that aspartame is made of. Phenylalanine is a single amino acid, and it causes people to consume huge amounts of this one amino acid, which could create an amino acid imbalance. And I wonder if there was any intention of maybe finding another a diet sweetener to replace aspartame.
Mark, do you want
Michael,
to take that?
Michael, I don't want to hog this. Do you want to comment on that?
I didn't Michael. Look too much into the issue of aspartame in my book, so I did look at it a little bit. And you know, you could write a separate book just based on aspartame. You know, the data is really mixed on it. There's no kind of definitive evidence that aspartame causes health problems, although there are some studies that have tied it to brain damage and headaches, dizziness, convulsions, all kinds of negative health effects. I do know that Coke, it's interesting, they just produced an advertisement I saw where they were touting aspartame as a healthy alternative to sugar. So they were sort of doing it as a public health announcement through their ads. But I also know that they have been working like crazy to develop other sweeteners as well, like stevia and other more different kinds of sweeteners derived from other as I say, natural sources, and I don't know a whole lot about that. Maybe Mark does.
Yeah, they are trying. They call it the holy grail of the soft drink industry, is to try to find a good tasting, natural, low calorie sweetener. Stevia does not really fit the bill because it has kind of a kerosene aftertaste. And the reason they're frantic about it is that people don't like artificial sweeteners. The fact is, I don't think there is any good, compelling evidence that artificial sweeteners are bad for you. There's some studies, but as far as I know, none of them have been replicated. And if there were good evidence, then, you know, it would be banned. So I personally am not that concerned about artificial sweeteners, although I know that's going to get me in trouble with a lot of listeners. I would prefer them to sugar.
Well,
because the sugar is what's causing diabetes. I mean, the obesity epidemic is a huge, huge, very real problem in this country.
Yeah, and there's a lot of really great research out there. Cornucopia has done a lot of great research on aspartame and sweeteners, so you might want to check that out. And I wanted to ask you both just quickly. We only have a couple minutes left. You know, I'm always struck when I go, like, I went to Belize over the holidays and Costa Rica last year and fairly remote parts of the countries. And every single small shop had a Coca-Cola sign. So it would say, you know, Rose's Place, but Coca-Cola, the logo would be under it. And I stopped in and asked people about it. And they said that these reps from Coca-Cola come out and say, you know, we'll fix up your place. We'll give you a sign. You just have to have our logo on it. Mark, how are they able to do that? How are they able to go to some of the most remote parts of the globe?
I mean, they started doing this in the United States right after 1886. They started painting walls with Coca-Cola. It's what they're best at. They realize that, you know, to get their logo up there and out there is very important. So they've always paid for, you know, signs up in sporting venues or certainly point of purchase, such as you're mentioning. By the way, in Belize, I don't know if you know this, but the Coca-Cola company bought about a third of the landmass of Belize. They were going to grow orange groves there, cut down the rainforest. but huge protests got them to give it to the government for a national park refuge instead. So,
oh, wow, just the
protests can do some good.
The protest did that. And Michael, any other tidbits you'd like to share just about the how Coke does its business practices around the world and how citizens are responding?
Well, I just wanted to address one thing that Mark talked about earlier, where I agree with a lot of the things that he said, but I do take issue a little bit about Coca-Cola's corporate social responsibility practices. I think that, they're very good at, as you say, getting their image out all over the world, and they really use some of these donations and these environmental initiatives to help burnish their image and also in some ways fight the criticisms of the company. But I think if you really look closely at a lot of them, they don't really address the criticisms directly. You know, for example, they give money to the World Wildlife Federation to save watersheds around the world, which is great, but the watersheds that they're saving are in countries that don't have water problems that can be tied to Coca-Cola bottling plants. So they'll be depleting water in India, and then they'll save a watershed in Brazil. And even in India itself, they'll do what they call rainwater harvesting efforts, where they will say that they're actually recharging aquifers by putting in these techniques that harvest the rainwater and to go directly to the groundwater. But those techniques only work when there's actually rain, and a lot of these places they're drought-stricken anyway, so they actually don't work, but they can sort of, you know, hold them up and get credit for it. And so I think there's a lot of sleight of hand that happens there, and I think that that's something that consumers should be aware of.
And Mark, do you want to respond just quickly? We've got about 30 seconds.
No, I think he's right. The rainwater harvesting is a great idea, but it only works if you have some water to harvest. I think Coca-Cola bears looking at. I just repeat, I don't think that they're the evil monster corporation of the world. People love to hate Coke because it's so good at what it does. I think that, you know, it's a complicated and complex history, and the issues are complex.
We're going to have to leave it there. That's Mark Pendergrast, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, and Michael Blanding is author of The Coke Machine. Thank you both for joining us. And thanks for listening. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss media coverage of the latest Walmart protests happening in over 15 cities. How are workers' rights being covered by the major media outlets? We'll also talk about how the media are covering the Obama administration's plan to strike Syria. We'll be joined by McClatchy's Mark Seibel, The Nation's Lee Fang, and In These Times' Mike Elk. What did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.